This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Jackie Leonard here from the Global News Podcast. Did you know there is an easy way to get new episodes automatically? Whether it's the Global News Podcast or indeed any of your other favourite BBC World Service podcasts, just find the show on your podcast app and then just click follow or subscribe. And if you switch on notifications, you'll get a reminder too. It's that easy. Follow or subscribe and never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones, and coming up in a minute we'll be heading to Germany, where a car has been driven at people enjoying a Christmas market in the city of Magdeburg. Also today, the US Congress has voted to avoid a government shutdown. What has that told us about President-elect Trump's relationship with Republicans on Capitol Hill, and how the civil war in Syria affected musicians there?
It seemed that any lyrics I would write, they don't express what really happened. No words can express what really happened back then.
So all those involved in music are wondering what the new authorities in Damascus will allow them to do. We'll take a look at that. But first we're going to Magdeburg in eastern Germany, where people had gathered at one of those traditional Christmas markets where there are little huts laid out selling fine food and glühwein and Christmas decoration and gifts. Not for the first time, one of these markets became a target for a vehicle used as a weapon. Shortly after the attack, police detained the driver of the car, and here's the moment they arrested him. Lars Fruhoff-Müller from the local public broadcaster, MDR, told the BBC what he'd seen.
Everywhere were ambulances, there were police, there were a lot of fireworks, and this was a real chaotic situation. We saw blood on the floor with people sitting beside and having these golden and silver foils around them. And we saw many doctors and so on, and trying to keep people warm and help them with their injuries. There are many emergencies. There was a helicopter. They bring people to the hospitals in Magdeburg and around the city, and also many ambulance mobiles parked in a big line at nearby the Christmas market. It's a big shock. It's a big shock for every people here in Magdeburg, and also for every person in Saxony-Anhalt.
Well, the German Chancellor Scholz, has visited Magdeburg just this morning. He condemned the attack.
What a terrible act it is to injure and kill so many people there with such brutality. And that's why this is a terrible, tragic event in which we must all show our sympathy for the relatives, for the injured, and for the city of Magdeburg.
So that's the German Chancellor. And joining us now, Nicole Anger, member of the State Parliament of Die Linke, that is the left party in Saxony-Anhalt for Magdeburg. She lives just around the corner from this market. She had a friend there when it happened. Obviously, a terrifying thing to have a car piling through lots of people. What have your friends and others been telling you about what happened?
My friend was working in one of the market stalls there last night, and when he suddenly heard a loud bang and everybody started to scream and to run, and the people were really terrified, so they closed the stall and left the market, and he was very much afraid, so he called and asked if there's someone around they can come to talk and to sit together and spend evening together. And that's what we did last night, and watched the news and got all the information we could get about the situation here in Magdeburg.
Because these Christmas markets, they're in many, many cities, and I guess that's probably the busiest time when this happened in the evening, isn't it?
It is, indeed. It was Friday night, so everybody was looking forward to go into the weekend, wanted to spend time with family and friends on the market, have some drinks, some food, some talk, and just having a good time with lots of joy.
Yeah, so this is obviously going to make a massive impact on Magdeburg. You represent the area. You'll be thinking about this for the whole of the next year.
We are not that far at the moment. The shock is immense, is massive. So we just have a look at the situation now that all the people who were injured, who are looking for relatives, are fine now. And then we have to think about the next year.
What are you learning about the man who did this?
We already know that he is a 50-year-old guy from Saudi nation, and he worked here as a doctor for psychiatry. He's in Germany for about 18 years by the time. He should have been living in Magdeburg as well, but moved away about 40 kilometers far from here. And he is a supporter of the right-wing extremists.
Yeah, it's totally confusing. I mean, we're going to be talking about this in just a moment, but it's confusing as to what motivated him.
He finished to be a Muslim and wanted to prevent, that's what the right wing says, Islamization of Germany. So he radicalized by following the right-wing party here in Germany and radicalized.
Yeah. And just one last thought about this. I mean, it's always, you know, so easy to have hindsight, but there have been attacks on markets before. Are you surprised a car could get in?
I don't know. I mean, the market was secured by blocks, yeah. But you can give 100% secureness all around because you need gaps for delivery and things like that. So you have to open it from time to time. And the police is always on the market. So actually, you could have been having a feeling of being safe, but it's so weird that it happened.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for giving us that reaction from the ground there. Nicole Anger, who is a member of the State Parliament there in Magdeburg. Well, the German Interior Minister has been talking about the suspect, saying he was Islamophobic. Damien McGuinness is in Magdeburg. What's known about the suspect?
What we do know from officials is that he was a 50-year-old doctor, Saudi-born, has lived in Germany for a long time, for around 18 years, it's thought, was working in a clinic in this region, you know, on the surface, well integrated. He had expressed quite a lot of anti-Islam views in interviews in the media, on social media in particular. He said things like, there is no such thing as a good Islam. He retweeted posts by far-right leaders here in Germany. He seemed to support some far-right ideas. At the same time, he also seemed to support, at some points, refugee rights. So a very, very complex picture.
That's Damien McGuinness, and indeed, that is confusing. Let's try and understand it with Dr. Hans Jakob Schindler, Senior Director at the Counter-Extremism Project in Berlin. Do you understand what was going through his mind? Can you put it all together?
It is very hard. The best guesstimate that you can make, looking at what he has been communicating over the last couple of years, is that he really belongs into this conspiratorial narrative category of extremists, which had been growing quite significantly since the corona epidemic, and social media companies are really not doing anything against those people. They are not quite effective in preventing Islamist terrorism content, which they know best. But conspiratorial narratives such as this, especially individualized conspiratorial narratives, because he also felt personally persecuted by the German police, is something that these companies simply don't look at, and the German security forces neither have the legal mandate nor the resources to monitor the entire internet all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, even if you had monitored the internet and seen his conspiracy theories, you wouldn't think they would lead to a violent act like this, would you?
Well, not necessarily, but he did say he is going to do an attack. He did say he's going to take revenge. So there were clear formulations. But the problem is, and this is going to be always a difficult thing of assessment for the security forces to go over. Unfortunately, because the big social media companies, in this case X, where all of this material is, have not gotten better, but they reduced their content monitoring capabilities and investments. You have so much hatred and so many fantasies of violence on the internet that it's really hard to distinguish what is just a person that is disturbed and just lives disturbed ideas out on the internet, and which one of those is a person that then gets into a car and plows through a Christmas market.
Yeah, I mean, you were with the Counter-Extremism Project in Berlin, and I guess we're broadening this out now, but what you're really saying is that the social media companies need to do a lot more to control the content that's going out on their platforms.
Well, more precisely, I would say they should do something. They are worse than they were a couple of years ago, yeah, because they have understood that there are no consequences for not doing anything. I mean, the French had to arrest the CEO of Telegram to get cooperation for the law enforcement on child pornography from Telegram. This is the state where we are. So we haven't developed into a positive direction. We've reversed, unfortunately, the last couple of years.
Now, I take your point that there were some worrying signs online. But nonetheless, it is unusual, isn't it, to have a conspiracy theorist. I mean, there are so many conspiracy theorists now, but they don't normally, unless they're backed by a major ideology of some kind, they don't go to violence. I mean, I can't think of another case where someone who just believes a whole lot of crazy things goes to this extent.
Yes and no. Of course, we did have an attempted coup d'etat by conspiracy theorists about 2 years ago. So there is some experience of violence from that milieu. There's even a special category now called the delegitimizers by the German security services, because you have this salad bar of weird and weirder ideological narratives that people adhere to, always anti-state, anti-government, anti-police. And there has been attempts to conduct violence quite frequently, especially since the corona pandemic in Germany. So there is, this threat is a new threat, but it's still very unknown. And this particular individual was a very strange subcategory of a subcategory.
Exactly.
And that's why yeah, likely he wasn't really realized as one who would be dangerous.
Yeah, but just listening to you there, basically he was anti-system. Is that the sort of broad category you could put him in?
That is the most fitting category when you say the police prosecutes me individually because I'm a critic of Islam and Germany as a society and the police are attempting to Islamicize Europe. That is the kind of conspiracy narrative that denies the legitimacy of the system. That's the best fit. But he remains a very weird character.
When you take these kind of arguments you're expressing to us to the authorities in Germany, do they listen?
Of course they do. But we in Germany are very strict when it comes to data protection for good historical reasons. We had two versions of a dictatorship in Germany, a brown one and a red one. So there is always a very strict legal corset for anything that has to do with large data analysis for the security forces. Mm-hmm. Hence, they don't have the legal mandate to do that. And then because of that, they don't have the technology that would allow them to do that, nor do they have the personnel. So it really is a always run against the clock on the security forces side, yeah, to get a handle on this. And they would need more than anyone else the help of these companies.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. Hans Jakob Schindler there speaking from Germany. Now, coming up, we'll be introducing you to the blob-headed fish.
It really is bizarre and extraordinary. It's a type of armored catfish. And what's interesting is it looks like its close relatives in every way, except that it has this massive extension on the end of its head. It's hard to describe it as anything other than a giant blob, almost like a big, strange nose.
It's in Peru, and it's a new discovery, new species. So we'll hear about that in 10 minutes. Headlines. Chancellor Scholz has said Germans must stand united after the attack on a Christmas market in Magdeburg, which killed at least 5 people. And Islamists have killed 16 Pakistani soldiers in a raid on an army outpost near Afghanistan. We'll be talking about that shortly too. And Russia says Ukraine has launched a drone attack on a city more than 900 kilometres from the border. In the midst of the scramble for a new Syria, the country's musicians watching the new Islamist leadership are wondering what's coming. You may think the recent years of conflict would have meant there was little time for music, but in fact, there was a steady beat of underground heavy metal and electronic dance music. what's going to happen to that music scene now. The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher has been speaking to musicians and fans in Damascus about their hopes and fears for Syria after the fall of the Assad government.
Syrian metal is war. That's the title of this documentary on an underground music scene that found energy and focus as the country was consumed with conflict. Nail al-Hadidi sold heavy metal cassettes in his music store some 20 years ago as local bands began to form. They operated in the shadows because the rebellious rock was forbidden.
Even if you grow hairs, going in black shirts, the security will take you. Yeah, they suspect that you are satanic or something.
Satanic?
Yes, that's what happened before the war. After the war, they were too busy to dig in this way.
So in a way, the war was good for heavy metal, that it gave you more space.
Yes, I can say that, but it is not good because most of people start to leave the country. 90% of my friends now in Europe, in Netherlands and Germany.
Wajid Khair is a musician who stayed, but he quit music when the killing started.
It seemed that any lyrics I would write, they don't express what really happened. No words can express what really happening back then.
Just last year, Wajid finally started playing and recording again, a different style of music this time. Now he's wondering what the new Islamist leadership, known as HTS, means for creative freedom. Is there any sense that you feel you need to keep a low profile until you figure out exactly where things are going musically?
Actually, no. We have to be heard. We have to let all the people know that we are here, we exist. It's not just Islamic fronts and Islamic states here. Actually, I don't think that keeping low profile under these circumstances is good for anyone.
As we were talking, some news flashed.
We just got news that HTS had closed the Opera House.
Yeah. It's not a good sign. It's not a good indicator for anything.
We rushed to the Opera House and were told it was a false alarm. The HTS is promising to respect rights and freedoms. The square in front of the Opera House was rocking. Safana Bakley had been trying to perform songs with the choir she directs.
Well, we just wanted to gather around and sing some of our songs and sing some revolutionary songs so that we bring some music.
So you came here with members of your choir to start singing, and then these young men joined with their drums and started turning
it
into...
Well, actually, it's our drum.
Oh, is it your drum?
Yes. We just gave it to them because they are so enthusiastic about using it.
Eventually, Safana managed to get some kind of order into the celebration. But it's electronic music that led the resurgence of Syria's nightlife over the past few years, with big dance parties in historic locations. DJ Maher Green is one of the musicians involved. He says people in the industry are preparing to approach the Islamist government.
We are willing to talk to them with logic. We are willing to talk to them with a real proposal. It doesn't seem like in the first week of freeing Syria, they are willing to look for the cultural side. They have a lot of other problems to look for. We are trying to organize ourselves before they are looking for the culture, so we get there first.
Like others here, Maher has been experimenting, mixing traditional Arabic music with electronic beats. He's wary about the conservative views of the rebels.
The culture is religious songs, religious melodies, and that's it. This is a little bit a backward for us. During the war, we have so much experiments, we have so much involved, we have so much mixed culture.
Syria's music scene has revived and even thrived during the civil war. Now it faces a new and unexpected test.
There we are, new sounds in Syria, and are they going to be allowed to continue? That was Barbara Plett-Usher. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is NewsHour. Pakistani Taliban militants say they carried out an attack on an army outpost in the northwest of the country near the border, killing 16 soldiers. And it does prompt the question, after the Afghan Taliban victory in Kabul and Kandahar, are the Pakistan Taliban making a comeback in Pakistan as well? Ikram Sehgal is a retired Pakistani army officer, a columnist and businessman with close links to the military. What does he make of this attack?
I think the problem that they're happening is that, of course, they're trying to make a comeback. But the fact of the matter remains, at the moment what has happened is that beginning they had a lot of success within Pakistan. Now that the Pakistan army started retaliating, they find it a little more difficult to cross the border. So they've started actually putting pressure on the Pakistan army on the borders to divert their resources.
You're basically saying that the Taliban attacks are not in Peshawar and other cities. They're now on the border. But nonetheless, it seems a very sophisticated attack from three positions with heavy weaponry.
I mean, they've had access to the best arms, which certainly surpasses the type of Pakistan army has. They've access to all the weapons that have been left by the Americans.
Doesn't it show how foolish the Pakistan army was to back the Afghan Taliban? It's blowback.
I think it was very foolish. And, you know, I've been saying that for a long time. The Americans were doing our dirty work for us, and we should have let the Americans keep on doing the dirty work for us. The moment they took Kabul, we knew that we were in trouble.
Well, some of you did. I mean, others were celebrating in the army.
Absolutely. And when I wrote an article a week, 10 days after that, you know, it caused celebrating and let's get our act together. You know, I was pilloried from post to post, you know, just to saying that, oh, this guy's just a doomsayer and things like that. But it was on the cards all along that once the Afghan Taliban were finished, they would ultimately go for Pakistan.
Now, at the same time as this military threat in the northwest, there is also the political problem that Imran Khan, the jailed politician, is by a long chalk the most popular man in the country, and the army have locked him up. Now they've locked up 25 of his supporters as well. How serious is that challenge to the army?
I think that is something that the army will have to resolve. You know, I mean, the army has to decide between what is the greater threat to them and the greater threat to Pakistan. And the greater threat to Pakistan is the threat which is coming from across the borders. And I think they need the support of all the political side, not only Imran Khan. And by the way, my own personal thing is that this is something that they had to give, but I think in the courts, this will not stand ultimately. So I think this is a moot point. I think the courts will bail the army out.
Right, you're saying the courts will overrule this military court decision to jail these people. But when you go to the senior army leaders and say, look, you're going to have to reach an accommodation with Imran Khan, I can't imagine they take that terribly well, do they?
No, I think at the end of the day, they are intelligent enough to realize that that accommodation of sorts is necessary. And I think some sort of back channel thing has started.
An interesting hint there of what may be to come with talk of a back channel there between the military and Imran Khan. That was Ikram Sehgal speaking there from Karachi. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, in a world where we so often hear of the threat to endangered species and of species becoming extinct, it's rather heartening to know that there are new ones still being discovered. An expedition to Peru's Alto Mayo region has discovered no fewer than 27 new species. They include an amphibious mouse with webbed feet and a blob-headed fish. Nestling between the Andes and the Amazon, Alto Mayo is a lush patchwork of jungles, wetlands and mountainous terrain. And Trond Larsen led an expedition there. He's the Senior Director for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Science at Conservation International. He's been speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall.
It's really an incredible, dynamic and diverse landscape. We have cities and towns and territories of indigenous peoples and local communities, but also fragments and larger pieces of these wild ecosystems of all different forest types and swamps and cloud forests. So just hugely varied and amazing terrain across the landscape where all of this biodiversity as well as people are thriving.
And you got very excited about the amphibious mouse.
I did get excited about the amphibious mouse because it belongs to this group of carnivorous semi-aquatic rodents. On past expeditions, you know, we always search for this group of rodents, and they're almost mythical because they're just so difficult to find and so naturally rare in most cases, and many species are just known by one or a few individuals. So finding any is really exciting, and to find one new to science is really thrilling.
And as you say, you've discovered these for science, but the people who live there live alongside these creatures, which is encouraging.
It is encouraging. And we work closely with indigenous Awahoon people who have a lot of extensive traditional knowledge of the area. You know, they were able to point the scientists to some of the best places where they could find really interesting species. And things like the blob-headed fish, which, you know, one of the incredible new species discoveries we made, is something that's very well known to the Awahoon people. And it's one of the fish that they catch and regularly eat for food.
Tell me a little bit more about the blob-headed fish, because it sounds extraordinary.
It really is bizarre and extraordinary. It's a type of armored catfish. And what's interesting is it looks like its close relatives in every way, except that it has this massive extension on the end of its head. It's hard to describe it as anything other than a giant blob, almost like a big strange nose. And the scientists have never seen anything like it, and we really have no clue what its function is.
I mean, overall, is the discovery of new species outpacing the extinction of existing species?
Well, that's hard to say. And of course, the discovery of new species doesn't necessarily change their conservation status, but it does help us to understand where things live, what things might have restricted ranges and be threatened with extinction, and ultimately to come up with better ways to make sure that they continue to survive into the future.
And that was Trond Larsen of Conservation International with Julian Marshall. You can see some pictures of these swimming mice, dwarf squirrels and blob-headed fish on the BBC News website. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, just 24 hours ago, the US media was full of stories about how a congressional deadlock could mean that some parts of the government would be forced to shut down, threatening transport and other systems just as the Christmas holidays got underway. Well, that crisis has been averted for now because Congress managed to pass a bill to fund the government for 3 months. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of the Democrats welcomed it.
After a chaotic few days in the House, it's good news that the bipartisan approach in the end prevailed. It's a good lesson for next year. Both sides have to work together. But by dealing with people who've had trouble with disasters, by helping our farmers avoiding harmful cuts, this is a good bill. It's a good outcome for America and the American people.
Well, let's just hear from Julia Manchester now from The Hill, because she's been following all this very closely. And I just want to try and untangle what the various actors in this have been thinking, Julia. So at the beginning of the week, there was a spending bill that was opposed by Elon Musk and Donald Trump Tuesday, Wednesday. Why did they oppose that bill? What was wrong with that from their point of view?
Yeah, good afternoon, Owen. You would think that with Republicans going into the new year with complete control of the White House and both chambers of Congress, they would be on board with this bill negotiated by Speaker Mike Johnson. However, we saw Elon Musk and Donald Trump come out against it, you know, for a number of reasons. One, the bill included a pay raise for members of Congress, something we haven't seen in the United States for a number of years. But also there was this question about raising or abolishing the debt limit. Now, this is something that has been a bit of a political pinata, if you will, in the U.S. for a number of years when negotiating averting government shutdowns. And Donald Trump and Elon Musk at the last minute threw that in. Now, in theory, I think there would be some unification on this with even some Democrats getting on board. But what you saw was conservative members of the House of Representatives from the House Freedom Caucus, a group of very fiscally conservative hawks, if you will, in the Republican caucus, essentially say, we don't want this unless there are major structural spending reforms, which that wouldn't be possible given the very short time frame they were looking at. So after that Plan B bill was, introduced, which included the bit about the debt limit, you had 38 House Republicans, many of them these very fiscal spending hawks coming out against it. Their future very much up in the air because we know that Musk and Trump have threatened primary challenges against them.
Right. Yes. And it's a complicated picture, but basically I think this would help unravel a bit of it. Elon Musk has been told to cut government spending. That's his brief. But at the same time, he wants to increase the debt ceiling. Is that because he wants tax cuts for people like him?
That's a good question. And you have, you know, a lot of people speculating about that. It's interesting. You hear Donald Trump and Elon Musk talking about, you know, abolishing or the debt limit or raising the debt limit. But at the same time, you have, some people within the Republican Party, and, you know, we could talk hours, about this, but I'll sum it up pretty briefly. You got Donald Trump campaigning this past election cycle with a very economic populist message. That's very different from what we've seen from the Republican Party in the past. You have him, talking about, for example, no taxes on tips, sort of issues that would probably benefit more working class voters. And we know that, pre-Trump, the Republican Party, a lot of their economic, financial stances weren't necessarily benefiting those voters, those issues, those portion of the population. So you have people like Elon Musk calling for this, but then at the same time, you have Trump allies like Steve Bannon, someone who very much embraces economic populism, calling for increased tax increases on corporations and wealthy Americans. So
exactly.
Clearly, a divide on this.
It is actually fascinating what's happening because, as you say, you've got the debt hawks who, and then you've got the orthodox Republicans saying cut taxes for the wealthy, basically, and then you've got Steve Bannon saying no, tax rises for the rich. And it's interesting this because he's been talking about the murder of that healthcare boss in Manhattan, saying it's a sign of just how much anti-elite anger there is, and the middle classes cannot be squeezed once again if the rich are getting cuts, tax cuts. Let's just listen to him. This is what he said at the annual gala this week of the New York Young Republican Club.
I hate to say it, you're going to have populist tax cuts on no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime. To make up that gap, I hate to say this, I know you got a bunch of still Republican Orthodox folks out here, you're going to have to raise taxes on the wealthy.
Right. Is that a realistic possibility? Steve Bannon, he's often ahead of what happens in U.S. politics.
He is. It's hard to tell because you have a lot of Republicans, Trump himself, who want to extend and expand on those 2017 Trump tax cuts that benefited a lot of wealthy Americans and corporations. His allies would say that benefited, the state of the U.S. economy from their perspective. So I think there certainly is a divide. But, just to zero in on that for one second, we heard Steve Bannon talk about a number of these, like I said, economic populist proposals, like, raising taxes on the wealthy, no taxes on tips. If you're following U.S. politics, definitely, the taxes on the wealthy, that's something we'll be watching. And I think you're going to see Republicans hedging their bets, watching how that debate plays out. But no taxes on tips. That's something we haven't seen that much from Republicans in the past. This past week, we saw Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, someone who is considered a part of the Republican orthodoxy class, if you will. He included in Virginia's annual budget a proposal that would eliminate no taxes on tips. So watch out for people who you would consider Republican, establishment Republicans, because they're even starting to embrace a lot of these economic populist initiatives, this agenda. I think it's showing a bit of a sea change within the party on this issue.
Yeah, no, it's actually fascinating. And thanks very much for bringing us up to date with it. That was Julia Manchester from The Hill, and the no tax on tips issue is interesting, not least because our people who are earning a lot going to declare that 90% of their salary was actually, guess what, a tip. Anyway, that's all to come in US politics over the next year. Now, since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, there have been people in the US making donations to support Ukrainians. And in the beginning, that support was overwhelming. But there are now signs that well away from the front lines, war weariness could be setting in. The BBC's Christina Volk reports.
In the city of Chernivtsi in West Ukraine, children open presents as their mothers watch in the background. Two young boys play with new footballs, while a girl in a knitted jumper smiles and holds up a doll with a big red bow in her hair. They have all lost a parent in the war. The presents were organized by a group of U.S. volunteers who have been collecting donations since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Some of those donations are organized by the owner of Veselka, a restaurant in New York.
I'm grateful and thankful that I have a loyal Ukrainian base in some small way.
We do our best from afar here.
Jason Burchard's grandparents fled Ukraine after the Second World War and became refugees in the U.S. When Russia's invasion began, Veselka quickly became the hub for New York's Ukrainian diaspora to organize help. But as the war has dragged on, Jason says donations are starting to dry up.
It's been a bit challenging, to be honest. They trickle in, but not as, you know, on the grandest scale as they once were. But now I think, you know, as we enter year three, people are very war weary and are not sure of what the future holds.
In Ukraine, Shana Galeyeva is distributing presents and other vital items like medical supplies with her charity, Bird of Light. Since the beginning of the war, she says, the charity has raised $5.8 million, mainly focusing on supporting children who have lost parents in the war.
These children writing letters to St. Nicholas, which is like a Ukrainian Santa Claus. Every single child writes, "My dream is for the war to be over so that we can all live and play with our friends." And then they become practical and they ask for things from soccer uniforms to like toys or makeup kits.
My name is Kira. I'm 13 years old.
Kira is one of the children that received a present this year. Her father went missing in the eastern Donbas region, which Russian forces are desperately trying to seize.
When this gift came, I was very happy. I wanted it for a long time. But still, when I think about the way it came to me, the price I had to pay for it, I am ready to give everything back, just to have my father returned. The most terrible thing for me is that my dad doesn't have a grave. I'm afraid to grow up. My dad was the one who would always give me advice. And now, without him, I don't know what to do or how to survive in the world while still helping my mom. This is the fear I feel inside me.
It's not just donations for Ukraine that are drying up. U.S. government support might also now be in doubt. Giuseppe Irto is from the German Kiel Institute for the World Economy. They track U.S. government assistance to Ukraine.
The U.S. in particular is the most significant donor of aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict. Therefore, the U.S. military aid represents the 50% of all military support.
Incoming President Donald Trump has previously criticized the amount the U.S. is spending on military support for Ukraine. It's not clear if, or by how much, another support package will be approved.
The funds established by the Biden administration to provide aid to Ukraine are set to run out by the end of the year.
Ukrainians like Shana now live with the uncertainty of new U.S. leadership.
I believe in humanity, although it's getting harder and harder. But I want to believe that this year, 2025, is going to be the year when kindness and goodness will prevail. Although the new administration in America, there's so much concern about it. To me, it's like the fight between the darkness and the light. So let's please support the light together.
And that was Christina Volk talking there about aid for Ukraine. And don't forget, you're listening to NewsHour now, and it is available, not live, but on the podcast, twice a day, every day of the year. So if you ever miss an edition, want to get up to date with what's going on around the world, that's the NewsHour podcast. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, war crimes trials are always subject to the criticism that they really amount to victor's justice. But at the same time, those involved in various post-conflict judicial processes point out that in war, crimes are often committed and perpetrators should be held to account. It is a feature of modern conflict that activists start gathering evidence of war crimes in real time, which is what's been happening in Syria in recent years. Well, one man who's just been to Syria to investigate and presumably to look at some of that evidence, we'll hear about that, is Stephen Rapp, an American lawyer, academic and former Democratic congressman. He's served as the US ambassador at large for war crimes issues under Obama and is the current chair of the Commission for International Justice and Accountability Board of Commissioners. So, Stephen Rapp, welcome. You're back in Washington. How long did you spend in Syria?
Just about 4 days, Monday through Thursday of this week.
Right. And what did you see?
Well, I saw one enormous exhilaration, Syrians cheering in the streets, a smile on every face, places that people couldn't go to, parks and high lookouts above the city occupied by whole families, rejoicing that this dictatorship of 54 years has ended. And then, of course, I saw the dungeons in which really tens of thousands of people were tortured to death, surrounded by families seeking any documentation, any information about what happened to their loved ones. I saw two of the mass graves that we had identified from satellite imagery and from insider testimony of those that dug the graves and saw their bones and evidence that what we feared indeed did happen.
And that was mass graves that were being used by the regime, right, by the government, not any of the other groups in Syria.
No, used by the regimes. Of course, we had in the Caesar photos, photos that were smuggled out by a Syrian military police photographer, images of at least 7,000 specific individuals that had been tortured to death in five regime facilities during 2012 and 2013. We've had another individual who came out in 2017 that was the supervisor of at least the first two mass graves and described those bodies and then, of course, bodies to follow in 14, 15, 16, 17 being brought to those cemeteries, at least twice a week in refrigerated trucks, badly decomposed bodies and buried after the digging of trenches that were about 5 meters deep.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely horrendous. Now, Bashar al-Assad is in Moscow. He presumably, therefore, will not be brought to justice.
Well, lots of people have thought they could get away with these crimes, and we should never say never. Milosevic and Charles Taylor and Ratko Mladic and Karadzic and others thought they would escape justice, and eventually the pressures were brought, and countries found it in their political interest to surrender these butchers to face justice, to face the victims and survivors of their crimes.
Should it just be the leaders who are held to account, or those who will doubtless say they were just following orders?
Well, following orders isn't an excuse, but one had in Syria a system of state terror where if you didn't participate, you too would soon be in one of those mass graves. The interim authorities have recognized that in the sense that they've once said they have no interest in prosecuting conscripts, drafted soldiers, and have already released those individuals and ordered their forces to do nothing to harm them. And I understand from a number of instances those orders are being followed. And I think that's appropriate. To be frank, the number of people that could be prosecuted is I suppose, in the tens of thousands. But my focus in most of the situations that we've dealt with is to deal with the major leaders, the ones that really made it happen, and to make sure that they're quality trials with due process and respect for human rights and proper defense and participation of victims and all of that, and then develop other ways to establish the truth about the bigger picture and what truly happened, and to either have a commission to do that or some kind of a reporting mechanism under which documents are released and information is provided.
Yeah, you just sort of mentioned some of the big names from the former Yugoslav conflict and the justice system that was introduced for that. Is the evidence in this Syrian case worse, equal, or better than what you had for that one?
Well, it is frankly much, much better, in part because this regime was extremely bureaucratic and had multiple organs all working together in this, almost competitively in it, and they communicated back and forth. A non-governmental group that I now head, the CIJA, Commission for International Justice and Accountability, had brought with Syrian participants and employees and staff more than 1.3 million pages out of Syria. Often material on meetings in Damascus that we found in Aleppo, but of course now when we actually get to the sort of the belly of the beast, we find 10 times that many documents. So of course some of them are being pilfered. In the case in the Palestine branch 235, the main evidence room has been burned up. Some is lost, but so much is communicated back and forth that as long as security is maintained of these facilities, I think it will be possible to basically fill in the whole picture. And indeed, that picture has already revealed a campaign of mass terror, torture, disappearance, etc., that's killed at least 100,000 Syrians.
Now, the new authorities in Syria have so much to worry about, so much to do. I mean, this issue's no doubt there, but there will be many other priorities. How much priority do you think it should be given versus other issues? And do you think their terrorist designation is a problem in that it, you know, reduce the amount of international cooperation they want to do?
Well, I met on Thursday, the day before Assistant Secretary Leaf met with members of the government. I met on Thursday before I left Damascus with essentially the acting foreign minister, who indicated that this was a very, very high priority for them. I have certain things that I think they need to do in terms of the kind of three steps here, in terms of the documentation, in terms of the mass graves, and then in terms of sort of developing the beginnings of a structure for a judiciary to handle these major cases. There's no question that the sanctions do create an obstacle for organizations even like the CIJA, which is supported by a variety of government's donations, and those donations might be held up if we're participating with a designated terrorist organization.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Stephen Rapp. The program's coming to an end, and we're very grateful for your time and for your very clear explanation of what you're doing and what you think ought to happen there. You bring us to an end of the program. Thanks for listening from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London. Goodbye.
Hello, Jackie Leonard here from the Global News Podcast. Did you know there is an easy way to get new episodes automatically? Whether it's the Global News Podcast or indeed any of your other favourite BBC World Service podcasts, just find the show on your podcast app and then just click follow or subscribe. And if you switch on notifications, you'll get a reminder too. It's that easy. Follow or subscribe and never miss an episode.
You are bound to devote yourself to the long conflict between the light and the dark.
The Dark is Rising, an immersive audio adventure, adapting Susan Cooper's classic fantasy novel into a gripping 12-part family drama.
Everything had changed.
The Dark is Rising. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.